Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a weekly show where we speak with the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Dr. Mona Siddiqui, Chief Data Officer of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. She's overseeing a targeted effort to create a seamless interface between all the health data stored at the various departments at HHS. Lori Robertson also checks in, the managing editor of factcheck.org, looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. And you can also find us on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you listen to podcasts. Please feel free to leave us a review there. Now, stay tuned for our interview with Chief Data Officer at HHS, Dr. Mona Siddiqui, on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Dr. Mona Siddiqui, Chief Data Officer at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, where she is tasked with building an agency-wide data management strategy. Prior to becoming the CDO, Dr. Siddiqui served as the health lead for the White House Social and Behavioral Health Science team during the Obama administration. Dr. Siddiqui is on the faculty at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, where she earned her medical degree. She earned a master's in quantitative methods from the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Dr. Siddiqui, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you so much.
Well, HHS is sitting on a treasure trove of health data that really holds the power to advance healthcare and medicine, as well as better inform national health policy. But the liquidity of that data still presents a major challenge. And while your team is actively working on this, HHS currently doesn't have a common practice in place for data sharing between departments at the agency. And I'm wondering if you could tell our listeners about the Data Insights Initiative and the efforts underway to align data sharing protocols between all of the divisions of HHS.
Yeah, so really the underlying premise is, how does an organization become more data-driven in the way in which it makes decisions around policies and resource allocation? And are we using our data to the maximum possible capacity in achieving that vision? It turns out that there really isn't a process in place right now for all the departments, all the agencies within HHS to share data in a seamless way, so that if an individual in one agency requests data from another agency, oftentimes it can take just as long as if that internal person was an external individual to the department. So those data use agreements can take about a year to negotiate, and there isn't any transparency built into the process. So what we are really charged with is building an enterprise-wide governance model for HHS that creates a more transparent, accountable, and consistent process for sharing data across agencies to really have a more data-driven approach to decision-making. As we do that, we are also looking to see how we can begin to harmonize the legal interpretations for how we share data. So depending on who you speak to when you're part of a data sharing negotiation process, words can be interpreted in very different ways. And we want to really start to understand, how are those processes getting handled right now? What are the variations at the agencies, and how can we begin to address that variation to create a more consistent model for the department as a whole? And so there's not just the governance piece and the legal side of this conversation, but then the other piece is, how do we create a technical platform that can enable that data sharing to happen in a more seamless way? And that's really about, again, harmonizing the workflow so that somebody sitting in one agency can put in a request that can get tracked, where there is accountability, and somebody on the other end has a defined time period within which to respond to that initial request, and where we can begin to bring data together, do data linkage where appropriate, and behind the HHS firewall, understand in a more holistic way the ways in which right now agencies are seeing things in silos. We want to really bring together and inform the decision-making process. So I always say this is really a 15 to 20-year journey for any department. And, you know, my job is really to make sure that we lay the foundation that is strong, both on the governance side and the platform side, to enable this journey to begin. And we can't let complexity really stop us from taking that first big leap.
I think, Dr. Siddiqui, even harder to imagine the sheer volume of these data sets that you're trying to align. I understand you have decades of information from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, from the FDA, from Medicare, from Medicaid, and I know that I'm probably only naming a few of them. Talk us through, at a high level anyway, the processes required to manage such vast data sets and then to build a seamless interface between them. I'm sure the challenges are bountiful, but what are a couple of the biggest ones for you?
Well, so, you know, right now, all of those different agencies really manage their own data. So our agencies get data from states or from hospital associations and some data that they collect themselves. But that process is really within the purview of the agency. And that entire life cycle of getting the data, cleaning up the data, and making sure that it's in a usable format, we're not trying to change that process, really. We know that the data stewards at those agencies have the expertise and the best sense of how to manage that data. We want to build a structure. When we say governance, it's really about the people, processes, and the technology needed to have in place to enable data sharing. So really, our focus right now is to create those pipes and those processes that we really need in order to be able to share the data in a more seamless way without letting the complexity of the different architecture at each agency be the thing that stops us from making that progress.
Dr. Siddiqui, a lot of tech enthusiasts and leaders like yourself have been at HHS to help liberate the data, and we've been honored to have a number of them on our show: Farzad Mustashari, Brian Sivak, Todd Park, and Susanna Fox. But it takes a lot more time than some had hoped to get that data liberated. And the HHS Idea Lab was created back in 2013 to accelerate that pace of transformation, applying entrepreneurial methods into the development process. And I'm wondering if you could share a little more about the Ignite Accelerator at the Idea Lab and tell us about some of the innovative strategies that have been developed through that process.
Yes. So the Ignite Accelerator really was a program that was put in place by Brian to spur innovation at the front lines of HHS. So the idea being that our frontline staff are seeing the problems in really the most fully formed way and have pain points that sometimes just aren't getting addressed by the department as a whole. And before those problems become big, we want to be able to enable and empower those frontline staff to be able to address those pain points. And the Ignite Accelerator has not just done sort of those problem solving across the department, but really has transformed the culture of the department to embed innovation in every agency that we've worked with. And I believe at this point, we have had projects in the Ignite Accelerator from across all the different agencies at HHS. And so, you know, think about all of those individuals who then go back to their agencies after working on these projects through mentorship at the Idea Lab. They go back and they become champions for this way of approaching problems, of collaboration, of thinking outside the box, and of working with the private sector in a really meaningful way. And again, I think it's that culture of innovation, and I don't use that word lightly. I think it's that culture that has led us to where we are today on a journey to a fairly massive undertaking for the department and becoming more data-driven. A lot of the individuals who've gone through the Idea of Lab Accelerator actually have raised their hands to come and work on this data portfolio now, which I think is really a testament to the strength of the program over the years and the feeling of empowerment that these individuals have had and wanting to make sure that they are part of this journey moving forward.
Well, Dr. Siddiqui, your outgoing Chief Technology Officer, Bruce Greenstein, has said that he's particularly proud of the initiative to accelerate strategies for battling the opioid crisis. And he's called that in part a crisis of a lack of actionable data. I know earlier this year, your agency hosted an opioid codeathon to bring together experts from technology and data science and government sectors, all seeking to develop better tools for public health officials and HHS to access data that's related to this deadly epidemic. Can you talk with us about the genesis of this initiative specifically and what you think you might be able to achieve here and if you have any promising early results or outcomes to date?
Yeah, of course. We were privileged to host the Opioid Codeathon at the department in December. And really the genesis of it was the call to action for the entire department to take part in doing its part to help address the opioid epidemic. And just because our office focuses on technology and data doesn't mean that we don't have an important role to play in all of the department's priorities, especially a public health emergency like the opioid epidemic. You know, I'm also a physician, so from that perspective, I will just say that this is, you know, speaking from the front lines, this is one of the worst public health crises that our country has seen, and we all need to do our part. And so our office really said that we can, through our work on the open data side, really create an opportunity to open the doors of HHS to the private sector to come and help us in addressing this crisis through data. And we compiled about 70 data assets from across HHS, from the Department of Justice, from the Department of Transportation, the Department of Education, Census Bureau. We had about 7 states that participated and brought data for the first time, and one private entity as well. And so 70 data assets for one event, and we had about 250 people come from across the country to participate. And really the range of participants was fantastic to see. We had academics, we had industry, we had startups. About 60% of the people who participated did not identify healthcare as their primary domain of expertise, which in my mind really says that, people are looking for an opportunity to help the federal government in this journey, and data really can be the way in which we all work together and the thing we convene around. We had solutions, we requested solutions around 3 specific areas. One was around opioid prevention, one was on solutions for treatment, and the third was an understanding opioid usage. So we had a winner in each of those tracks, and each of those winners are actually continuing to build their solutions, which to me is a testament that this wasn't just a one-and-done event, but really a continuing movement forward. And, we are in constant communications with those companies to see how we can continue to support their work moving forward. And as they develop their solutions further, you know, we hope to continue to partner in helping facilitate connections for testing and scaling.
We're speaking today with Dr. Mona Siddiqui, Chief Data Officer at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, where she is tasked with building an agency-wide data management strategy. Prior to becoming the CDO, Dr. Siddiqui served as health lead for the White House Social and Behavioral Health Sciences team. Dr. Siddiqui, one of the important goals of all of these initiatives, and you were talking about it in a specific area, but is to really make all of this streamlined data available to the outside world for research, spark citizen scientists. Healthdata.gov is the portal through which developers and entrepreneurs can access data for research and development. How do you see this portal ultimately accelerating the pace of research, both within the agency, but more broadly in the research community?
I think it's a testament to Todd and Brian and Susanna that over the course of many years, 2,000 data sets were released for public use through healthdata.gov. And I think that's really a phenomenal testament to the leadership at the department for a long time in being incredible proponents of data as a way to make government more open and as the way in which we can continue to collaborate with entrepreneurs and researchers who have a different and unique perspective to be able to bring to some of the most complex problems that the country is facing today. And I really want to make sure that we continue those efforts, that healthdata.gov is the place for accessing not just data from the federal government, from the healthcare side, but more and more we have states and counties that have put data on healthdata.gov. And we hope to be able to bring more of that granular data to healthdata.gov so that it can continue to be a place for people from all different backgrounds to be able to get access to data that they otherwise would not be able to. We also want to make sure that we understand where the demand is from our stakeholders and what data should be made publicly available. And in the coming months, we're going to be reaching out more to that community to get a better understanding of what they would like to see from healthdata.gov, both in terms of the data sets that are publicly available, but also additional tools that might help in actually working with the data. So as we make data more discoverable, we also want to make sure that we continue to make that data more usable.
Well, Dr. Siddiqui, I know you've joined with your predecessors in this quest to liberate the data and the right kind of data, but also data that is timely. And you referenced this a few minutes ago in our conversation about this issue of the timeliness of data. We had Harvard's Dr. Schaff recently joined us, and he was saying he was just perplexed by the fact that, one, he has to pay money for Medicare data sets, but two, he just has to wait a long time to get them. And three, when he gets them, they're already several years old. And just commented on how frustrating it is always for research to not have access to the most timely data. And I think you acknowledged at the recent Health Data Palooza appearance that you made and also earlier in the show, it could take 15 or 20 years to get all the data moving the way everybody would like it to. Tell us a little more about the long-term expectations for the robust sharing of the HHS health data. Certainly, we know the intention is to get there. What's it going to take to get there? And can that time frame be accelerated, or do you think this is just the nature of what we're going to have to expect?
So I would say I'm an incredibly impatient person, and I would hope that time frame can certainly be accelerated. You know, as we've taken a deep dive into our agencies and our team has really fanned across HHS over the last several months and spent sometimes between, 10, 12 hours at every agency in talking to leadership and in talking to data stewards of some of the most high-value data assets across HHS, this is a multi-layered issue, one of which is, and I don't think we often talk about it, is each of our agencies are governed by different statutory requirements. And sometimes each of our data assets have very different regulations that govern that data collection activity. And so when we talk about the sharing of data, and again, just to reiterate this, right now we're just talking about how do we create a more seamless process for internal data sharing to happen so we can start to use our data as an asset. Well, part of that is going to involve questions around legal interpretations within the context of the different statutes and regulations that we are all governed by, and harmonization of that. It's not something that has been done previously. So, again, this is an incremental process. We aren't saying that we want to boil the ocean here. We are embedding our work around business use cases for the department. So our first use case is the opioid epidemic, and we're saying, our initial look is what are the data assets that are high value for this specific use case? How can we begin to do some data linkage and analysis and show value from that data? As we do that, we will work to look at the legal agreements that govern that process and harmonize it to the extent possible, and then take it to the next use case. So rather than, spending time doing a complete landscape analysis, which would take another 10 years. We really do think that it is our job to show value from data and value from the process in order to really change the way in which change the culture and show not just to our leadership but to our agencies and the staff that there is value in being a part of this process.
Dr. Siddiqui, let me get one last question in here. Margaret brought up Health Data Palooza, and I'm reminded of a conversation we just had with the co-chair of that event, Dr. Rasu Shrestha, Chief Innovation Officer at University of Pittsburgh's Medical Center, who noted that we're going to see an acceleration of health data sharing in the coming years as the move towards precision medicine and artificial intelligence begin to take hold in the marketplace. HHS's Chief Technology Officer launched a program called HHS Startup Day, where entrepreneurs can sell their innovative ideas to HHS. Tell our listeners a little more about that program.
So our office often says that we are the front door for startups, and that is really the ultimate mission that we have. We want to demystify the ways in which the federal government operates, and we want to create as level of a playing field for those small startups that have some really big ideas and really innovative solutions. We don't want to be the last customer for those startups. We want insight into what is happening in the market. Right now, I think a lot of times the folks that make at meetings are the big corporations, and that is the culture that we would like to change. And so HHS Startup Day is really our attempt to bring together that community with the leadership at HHS. The first event in Washington, D.C., we had representatives from FDA and from CMS, from our acquisitions folks at HHS, along with NIH and others. And it was a great way to provide feedback to the startup community about what we are looking for and for us to hear the pain points from that community and to understand, you know, how can we help smooth that pathway for them. So the next one was in Boston, and we've had one in Nashville, and we are continuing the roadshow, and we'll be having additional events around the country both this year and next year. And, you know, hope that this is the start, really, and the first step in a more meaningful way to engage with that community.
Perfect. We've been speaking today with Dr. Mona Siddiqui, Chief Data Officer at the Department of Health and Human Services. You can learn more about their work by going to hhs.gov/idealab, and you can follow her on Twitter at Mona Siddiqui, MD. Dr. Siddiqui, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
With Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy's retirement, President Trump can nominate another justice to the court. That has sparked concern among Democratic politicians that the court's landmark decision in Roe v. Wade, making abortion legal nationwide, could be overturned. For instance, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer wrote in an op-ed in the New York Times that there were, quote, at least 20 states poised to ban abortion immediately if the 1973 decision is overturned. What would happen if Roe v. Wade went away? Jurisdiction would go back to the states, which then would be able to decide whether or not to allow abortion or what restrictions to impose. The Guttmacher Institute, a reproductive health research organization whose work has been cited by both sides in the debate, says that 17 states have laws that could restrict abortion, while 9 states have laws that protect abortion rights. Among the first group, the 17 states that could restrict abortion, 4 of them have laws calling for abortion to be banned automatically if Roe v. Wade were overturned. Those 4 are Louisiana, Mississippi, North Dakota, and South Dakota. 10 states have bans on abortion that have been on the books since before the 1973 Supreme Court decision, most with an exception for the life of the mother. Some states may reconsider those old laws should Roe be eliminated. Massachusetts, for instance, is one of those states. And 7 states have passed laws expressing an intent to put restrictions on abortion as permitted by the high court if Roe were overturned. As for the 9 states that have laws calling for the protection of abortion rights, those are California, Connecticut, Delaware, Hawaii, Maine, Maryland, Nevada, Oregon, and Washington. The Center for Reproductive Rights, a legal advocacy group, says in its evaluation of the issue that if Roe is overturned, 23 states could ban the procedure and 19 other states could protect abortion rights. In the 9 remaining states, which include the nation's capital, abortion rights would be at some risk, the group says. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Diabetes affects 30 million Americans, and management of the chronic illness can often prove challenging for patients who must keep vigilant about things such as diet and exercise to stay healthy. And when the patient population is part of an ethnic minority, language and cultural barriers prove an additional challenge for clinicians seeking to improve the health of their diabetic patients. Researchers at the NYU School of Medicine Department of Population Health decided to target their efforts on the city's Bangladeshi community who suffer from high rates of diabetes.
The community health worker model, I like to use the metaphor of a bridge. You know, CHWs really serve as a bridge between communities and between systems of care. And because CHWs are respected and trusted individuals in their own communities, they're able to connect people to care and connect people to resources and information in ways that's understandable and relevant for them.
Nadia Islam trained a group of community health workers to meet the participants in their home and communities to help the test group better manage their condition.
There's thousands of diabetes management curriculum out there, but they are often not targeted, culturally tailored for specific communities. And if you think about something like diabetes, the nutritional aspects of diabetes are so critical. Engaging in physical activity is a critical piece of management. So we worked with our coalition to completely culturally tailor a curriculum. It was delivered in language by our community health workers in group settings with some one-on-one follow-up as well.
Islam says community health workers gained the trust of patients they were assigned to, helping them and their families adhere to important diet and exercise regimes.
Bangladeshi community is a predominantly Muslim community, and we found early on that female participants in particular expressed hesitations and barriers to finding what they perceived as appropriate places for physical activity. And so we actually created an at-home, culturally tailored physical activity DVD that was very low resource. We created an in-language, at-home DVD for participants to kind of give them easy strategies for incorporating physical activity into their daily routine. You know, another key piece of diabetes management is, you know, making sure you're seeing your primary care physician. You know, for a lot of our female participants, for example, they were relying on their male family members to accompany them. If your husband or your uncle or your father is a taxi driver or a restaurant worker working a 16-hour shift, it's going to be difficult for them to always accompany you to physician's appointments. So our CHWs really worked with participants, especially female participants, on enhancing self-efficacy around things like using the transportation system.
And the results were significant. Islam says in 6 months, 55% of the test group who worked with community health workers managed to keep their blood sugar levels at or below 7%, a dramatic improvement over the participants in the control group who did not have the community health worker intervention.
What we found was that for participants who had a higher A1C when they started the program, they were more likely to experience a greater drop in A1C over the 6 months if they were linked to a CHW compared to those who weren't.
A targeted, culturally relevant community health worker approach to helping patients better manage their diabetes, providing a low-cost intervention that has yielded significant improvement in diabetes control in an at-risk population, yielding better health outcomes and lower health expenditures. Now that's a bright idea. You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.